scheme that mandates a life sentence for a juvenile is unconstitutional as cruel and unusual punishment. The sentencer must consider the defendant's youth and conduct an individualized sentencing, considering the youth, as what the appropriate sentence is. But Miller, according to Montgomery, did not impose a particular fact-finding requirement. It does require courts to make a distinction between juvenile defendants whose, and I'm going to quote the language here, crime reflects unfortunate yet transient immaturity from juvenile defendants whose crime reflects permanent incorrigibility. Now, when Scott was sentenced, all the parties agreed that the court had the absolute authority to give him 20 years, the mandatory minimum. The defense recommended a 20-year sentence based primarily on his age and on his youth. The trial court rejected that.
Isn't the way we think about youth now different than it was in 1993 when Judge Bates imposed this sentence? I mean, there's a whole wealth of knowledge that we now have about juveniles that we didn't have back then. So wouldn't there, if he were to be resentenced today and youth was to be taken into account, wouldn't we be thinking about it much differently than Judge Bates did?
Not under these circumstances. And frankly, I don't think there's been
a sea change.
Well, first of all, we've always had a separate juvenile court system that's based on the premise that people under 18 are less mature and less culpable. Well, so the idea that we've suddenly discovered this idea based on recent neuroscience, I think, is...
Well, why did Montgomery think there was a significant change in the law? Isn't that what they thought?
Yes. So,
they did
because there were states...
I don't think you can argue that it wasn't.
Okay. There were states that mandated life without parole for juveniles, including the state of Washington. What Montgomery and Miller say, though, is that there is still a small group of juvenile offenders for whom a life sentence is an appropriate sentence under Eighth Amendment, and it's based on the facts of the crime. Do the facts of the crime reflect transient immaturity, or do the facts of the crime reflect
incorrigibility? Well, it's not just based on the facts of the crime. It's based on the individual who's in front of you is being sentenced as well, doesn't it?
No. It's based on the facts of the crime.
So if it's a horrible crime, then automatically we impose a life sentence. Is that what you're saying?
Not automatically.
A life sentence is okay.
But if it's especially heinous murder, then a life sentence does not violate the Eighth Amendment. Here's the language from Montgomery. Even if a court considers a child's age before sentencing him or her to lifetime in prison, that sentence still violates the Eighth Amendment for a child whose crime reflects unfortunate yet transient immaturity if rendered life... Okay. And then they go...
Are you reading from Miller?
I'm reading from Montgomery.
Well, the crimes committed in Miller were... quite heinous, as I recall. And yet, weren't those sentences reversed?
They were remanded.
Remanded?
For the individualized determination.
Exactly.
So they didn't say you can't impose a life sentence. They said you have to consider his youth and when deciding what the sentence is. Because remember, in Miller, it was an automatic life sentence.
We can see here from our perch here on the appellate court that this was a particularly heinous crime. So we're not going to remand because the nature of the crime was so heinous that we're satisfied that it was an appropriate sentence for the judge to impose. There's no need to go back and look at it again.
No, they didn't, because, remember, the judges in Miller had no discretion. Scott's sentencing judge had discretion. He could have imposed a 20-year sentence. He could have accepted the defense argument that 20 years is enough for the 17-year-old. He did not. So there's a procedural requirement to Miller that the court must be able to consider youth, and there's
a substantive requirement. You have two parts of your argument, and so your first part, which you started out with, was that, well, it isn't really a sea change. We were thinking the same way back then, and so then you move on to this part of the argument. But I believe that we discussed how perhaps the very nature of Montgomery by saying that it was retroactive pulls the rug out from under the first part of your argument. It was a sea change. And so the courts in imposing this sentence were not thinking the same way.
No. I'm not saying that Miller's not retroactive or there's not a change in the law. I'm saying that Scott, for the substantive requirement, Scott falls into that small group of offenders for which a life sentence is not unconstitutional because the facts of the crime are so heinous. And that's what the trial court found, and it was appropriate process. But that's just all kind of an informative and interesting yet somewhat theoretical argument, because the fact of the matter is Washington has enacted the exact kind of statute that Montgomery says remedies any Eighth Amendment violation. 994A730, which applies to Scott.
We understand. That's the question that it seems that the respondent has not answered, which we will ask about. But with respect to your argument that these kind of sentences are fine because the crime is so heinous, I'm having difficulty with that because the Supreme Court has said that this should be rare, and yet it seems like all of the cases that come up in these types of cases, the crimes are heinous. I mean, the fact is that juveniles are committing heinous crimes. That's why they get these long sentences, and yet the court seems to think, it's better to think about it in this new way before you consign this person.
I disagree. I think that a juvenile who participates in a robbery with other people.
You disagree with what? You don't think,
I disagree
you don't
that all these
that,
cases have
you don't
heinous
think
facts.
That it should be rare?
No. I agree it should be rare.
What
I think
rare
these
mean,
are
then?
Rare facts. So I would
okay,
so,
that's my question.
Yes.
You see, that is a really difficult question from a legal standpoint, because you say, well, this is rare.
Yes.
Who says relative to what? That's the problem with trying to make something
be
rare.
Somebody has to say, right?
Yeah.
So there's a difference between a 14-year-old that gets caught up in a robbery that takes a tragic turn and ends up in the murder of a store clerk in which he didn't even commit the shooting, which is, I believe, the facts of Miller or perhaps Roper, or a street fight, a juvenile participating in a street fight that, again, takes a tragic turn and somebody ends up dead. Those are the kind of facts that are in some of these cases. And a 17-year-old who's just 5 months shy of his 18th birthday, who goes into the home of an elderly woman suffering from Alzheimer's and beats her to death with her own cane, causing multiple rib fractures, multiple skull fractures, multiple facial fractures, a neck fracture that goes completely through her spinal cord. He used two weapons.
We understand
the cane.
The facts of the case.
So
that
there's a small...
I'm not debating the facts of the case with
but
you.
But what I'm saying is if there's a small...
There are many, many brutal crimes of murder on the books of the appellate reports. All right.
I think you would be hard-pressed to come up with a crime that's worse than
all right.
This.
Very good.
And if there's
you
a small group, let me just say, if there's a small group of offenders for which a life sentence is still constitutional, Jamar Scott falls within that group.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Ellis. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Scott. What was once considered absurd can, with the passage of time, become the norm. And when I wrote that yesterday morning, it didn't have the same political overtones that it might this morning. But in this particular case, this Court of Appeals, back in 1993, said that Mr. Scott's claim that his youth could serve as a mitigating circumstance borders on the absurd, and rejected it wholesale in four sentences. Mr. Scott argued at the time of his sentencing to Judge Scott and then to this court that youth should be considered as a mitigating circumstance, specifically that it should relate to his capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct.
He argued that. Judge Bates responded to that argument and rejected that. How is that not an exercise of discretion that satisfies Miller and Montgomery?
Because what this court said, in keeping with what Judge Bates said, is that youth could never serve as a mitigating circumstance under the limited capacity. When the Washington Supreme Court reviewed that issue in O'Dell, it decided quite the opposite. It said that youth could, in fact, serve as a mitigating circumstance, citing, among other mitigating circumstances, the limited capacity. There is a question in O'Dell about whether O'Dell changed the law as it applied to all of Washington. There's a question of what, and I believe the case is pronounced Hamim, decided. But if you read O'Dell, it cites particularly this case, Scott. Scott is cited in O'Dell for the application of the wrong rule, for the application of a misreading of what the court in O'Dell said had been held in Hameem earlier. So if you just put those two cases together, you have Mr. Scott's case saying that youth can never serve as a mitigating circumstance, and then the court in O'Dell saying it must be available to serve as a mitigating circumstance. And I'll indicate that the one point of agreement that I have with the prosecutor is they are free to make arguments at a resentencing that the nature of the crime deserves harsh punishment and even the equivalence of life, although I disagree with the state's reading of the irreparable incorrigibility finding. They can make those arguments, but the point is that the law as applied, at least in Mr. Scott's case, was that youth could not serve as a mitigating circumstance, and now it can.
But counsel, you're referring to the Court of Appeals decision being rejected by the Supreme Court as being too broad. I was asking, though, about the trial judge, because Judge Scott didn't say the law does not permit it. He just dismissed that it should be applied to Mr. Scott at that time.
Right, and this court in Mr. Scott.
Well, he could have applied it. He didn't have to apply it.
This court held that it couldn't. I mean, this court.
But that was after the fact. That's my point. Is if we're looking at the sentencing itself, didn't he exercise discretion to reject the application of youth to that specific sentencing?
That is not what this court held. This court does not say at any point under the heading defendant's age as a mitigating factor that the court properly considered it, gave it appropriate weight, but found that it had such insignificant weight that it didn't justify an exceptional sentence. What this court said is that the argument that youth could serve as a mitigating factor borders on the absurd. It rejected it out of pocket with no further discussion.
I wonder if you could spend some time addressing the question of the Miller fix and why that under Montgomery is not the remedy that you must use.
Mm-hmm. Well, this court rejected that in Ronquillo. And it said that the possibility of parole did not justify a sentence where youth as an individualized factor, either as a mitigating factor under the state statute or as an individualized factor under the Eighth Amendment, children are different category of cases.
You might be reading Ronquillo too broadly if you think that's what it held, because in Ronquillo, the defendant was in front of the trial court in a way that Miller wasn't really ordering. It wasn't there because he had a life sentence. He was there for resentencing on a technicality that brought him back before the judge, and then the judge, sure, in the exercise of discretion, agreed to have a full-blown resentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
but Mr. Ronquillo was still eligible for parole at 20 years.
So, but is that your only answer?
No,
Ronquillo says Miller fix doesn't work?
No. I mean, my answer is that the Eighth Amendment requires an individualized determination. My argument is that the mitigating factor, which was categorically rejected in Mr. Scott's appeal, now clearly applies. And my argument is that parole is a different function than sentencing. Parole does not look at culpability. Parole does not look at your youth and its attendant circumstances.
So are you saying then that when Montgomery said there's a number of ways that states can deal with this, you're saying that Montgomery wasn't talking about a parole system?
I suppose you could create a parole system that considers the attributes of youth. That's not the parole system we have. The parole system that we have for juveniles says that you simply look at...
Your argument is that the Miller fix statute doesn't satisfy what the Montgomery comment on the Miller cases said.
Well, in this case, no.
You're attacking that statute, the Miller fix. It's not good enough.
It's not good enough when there hasn't been appropriate consideration of the individualized characteristics of youth at sentencing, and where there has been a rejection as inapplicable of a mitigating circumstance that we now know applies.
But Miller, Montgomery seems to say almost exactly the opposite. I mean, I understand your argument, which is, you know, sentencing in the first instance is the best place to actually consider the impact of youth on the sentence that ought to be imposed. But Miller explicitly says that allowing those offenders to be considered for parole ensures that juveniles, that juveniles whose crimes reflected only transient immaturity and who have since matured will not be forced to serve a disproportionate sentence in violation of the Eighth Amendment. So it does contemplate parole, and it cites a Wyoming statute where juvenile homicide offenders are eligible for parole after 25 years. It's even less here. It's 20 years. So I have a difficult time understanding how you can argue that this statement in Miller, at least as far as the federal constitution is concerned.
In Montgomery.
At least as far as the federal constitution is concerned, is not applicable to what we have here.
Because the Miller-Montgomery test is a two-part test. And what that satisfies is the test regarding life without our life sentences without findings of irreparable incorrigibility, right? So that providing parole satisfies that concern that juveniles must be given an opportunity to show change, to show that they're not irreparably corrupt. But it doesn't satisfy the first part of Miller-Montgomery, which has to do not with what must you find in order to impose a life sentence or when can a life sentence appropriately be imposed, but has to do with the individualized requirements that have to happen in a sentence.
So your argument is that indeed all of those folks who were sentenced before the Miller-Montgomery line of cases have to go back and be resentenced because there was no requirement of finding of irreparability, and arguably the findings weren't made, so they do have to go back for resentencing.
I think my first argument is to draw a very narrow rule that says at least as far as Mr. Scott is concerned with the application of the exceptional circumstances that the law has changed for him. For purposes of the Eighth Amendment, anybody who has a life or life equivalent sentence, there needs to be that finding. But more importantly, because parole may satisfy that aspect, more importantly, there has to be a consideration of youth and its attendant circumstances at the time of sentencing when you impose what now works as a statutory max. We now, in effect, have indeterminate sentencing for all youth prosecuted as adult. And in terms of setting that maximum time, the maximum that the person can serve before their sentence expires, youth must be considered under Miller-Montgomery. And that's a rule that is substantive and it applies retroactively. And states have to give effect to it, which is the first part, the procedural part of Montgomery.
Thank you.
So I think counsel's mischaracterizing the one sentence in this Court of Appeals opinion in Scott. Exceptional sentence below the standard range was never requested and, in fact, was not authorized because the low end of the standard range was the mandatory minimum of 20 years. On appeal, Scott argued that the 900 months was clearly excessive, and he argued it was clearly excessive because of Scott's youth. And this court said, I think completely consistent with Miller, that it's absurd to think that this crime that occurred in this case was attributable simply to the fact that Scott was 17 years old. Now, in rebuttal, I was going to quote from Montgomery versus Louisiana at page 736, but Judge Spearman, you've already quoted it, so I'm not going to belabor it, except to say that J.M.R. Scott no longer has a determinate sentence of 900 months. Because of the operation of the Miller fix, he now has a sentence of a minimum term of 20 years to life with eligibility for parole. And that sentence does not violate the Eighth Amendment under the explicit dictates of Montgomery. And therefore, there's no constitutional violation in this case resulting in actual substantial prejudice, and the collateral attack should be dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next case is